loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In our first hour, Vice President Mike Pence's speech to the Israeli Knesset yesterday was met with both standing ovations and physical scuffles as Arab members were evicted for protesting the U.S. decision to move its embassy to Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the New York Times Sunday Magazine has an article which strongly suggests that then-Prime Minister Ariel Sharon ordered Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to be assassinated in 2004. Plus, did you know that Donald Trump's father started off building affordable housing? That Donald Trump may be descended from a serial killer? Did you know that Trump is the first president to have children by three different women? Or that his children have never been permitted to have pets? We talked to the author of a great new book, Donald Trump in 100 Facts. The Attorney General has announced that the Department of Justice will be opening an investigation into the deletion of text messages between two former members of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russiagate team who are suspected of demonstrating a political bias. And in our second hour, five stories today. First, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is facing the wrath of his own party following the government shutdown. Progressive Democrats are upset that Schumer won almost nothing tangible in exchange for providing the votes to pass a continuing resolution, largely seen as a victory for President Trump. Next, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said yesterday that Turkey's offensive against Syria is disrupting efforts to finish off ISIS. French President Macron, meanwhile, criticized Turkey's human rights record in Syria. Then the Trump administration announced harsh new tariffs of as high as 50% on solar panels and washing machines, angering China and South Korea, where they're manufactured. Observers say these are only the first of Donald Trump's America First tariffs. And then Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva is a giant in Brazilian politics, but the former president is at a crossroads. He could finish this year in prison, serving a 9.5-year sentence for corruption, or once again, he could find himself as president of Brazil. And last today, we begin a new weekly segment where we take a look at the economic direction of the country. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Israel. Vice President Mike Pence's speech to the Israeli Knesset yesterday was met with both standing ovations and physical scuffles as Arab members were evicted for protesting the U.S. decision to move its embassy to Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the New York Times Sunday Magazine has an article which strongly suggests that then-Prime Minister Ariel Sharon ordered Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to be assassinated in 2004. We're joined from Amman, Jordan, by Daoud Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. And we're joined from London by Ambassador Manuel Hassassian, the Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ambassador, let's start with Vice President Pence's speech to the Israeli Knesset. This has been a love fest between the vice president and Israeli leaders, but Palestinian authorities are saying that the peace process is dead and that the U.S. no longer has credibility. Would you agree with that?
Of course I agree with that, because, you know, the visit of Pence comes timely and epitomizes unequivocally support of the United States to Israel. And the speech that he delivered in the Knesset, portrays anything. It portrays that there is total harmony between a colonial settler movement, Zionism, and that of the evangelist, you know, perception of Israel. So we were not surprised to hear such a speech because, you know, Pence from the very first day has been a supporter of Israel. He has been supporting settlements. And I don't see, you know, why Palestinians should not make statements like, this is the death for the peace process. Because the United States has shown, you know, so clearly now that they are on the other side of history. They have made their choice with Israel, and they have discredited themselves as an unspoken for the peace process. So what else can the Palestinians do except to seek alternatives? Mediators to this long-standing conflict between Palestinians and Israelis.
Daoud Kutab, that's really the point right there. Vice President Pence didn't even pretend to try to schedule meetings with Palestinian leaders. He met only with Israelis. So where do the Palestinians turn from here? Obviously, the United States is not going to be the honest broker. But in the event that the peace process is able to move forward, how does it get there? Does it go to the United Nations or to the European Union or to the Russians even? What do you think?
Well, too many points in that question, but I will try to tackle some of them. The visit was delayed twice. This was the third attempt to make that visit. And the reason for the delay was clear, that the Palestinians were not willing to meet with Mr. Pence. But more importantly, actually, than the Palestinians, was the actual original plan was that Mr. Pence somehow wanted to come and help Arab Christians in the Middle East, as if we needed his help. And this was totally rejected by Christian leaders, whether it's the cops, whether it's other leaders in Jerusalem or in Amman. Nobody wanted to meet with him. And in fact, he made it to Jerusalem. He visited the Western Wall, but he didn't even visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. He didn't visit the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Haram Sharif. So he actually did not do the basic even tourism part that you would do if you come to Jerusalem and if you really believe in anything to do with the rights of people in Jerusalem. But let's look at what he said at his speech in the Knesset. He spoke, he made like a 3,000-word speech. He mentioned the word Israel 28 times. He mentioned America and Iran 14 times, and he mentioned Jewish 13 times. In other words, he spoke about Iran more than he spoke about the Jews. I mean, it just shows how fixated he is on issues that have nothing to do with the peace process. Now, how many times did he mention Palestinians? Once. He only made one mention of Palestinians in his entire speech, saying he believes that there should be, you know, that the U.S. is committed to peace between Israelis and Palestinians. That's it. He didn't talk about the rights of Palestinians. He didn't talk about the rights. He didn't mention, of course, Muslims or Christians or whatever. It was only, you know, Jews and Iran was the main point of his speech. So what can I say? It was, you know, as you said, a love fest that actually is not very useful, because when you overreach so much to one side, you basically lose your opportunity or chance of having any kind of credibility with both sides. And I think that really did disqualify the U.S. In making any kind of approach to the Middle East conflict. And I think people have no way to oppose the Palestinian desire, saying we don't want Americans to be the only game in town anymore.
I think those are important points, John. The United States has undoubtedly, and as we all know, been one-sidedly on the side of the Israeli government as it carries out occupation, expansion, wars against its neighbors. Israel has the largest is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign economic and military aid. Right as he was leaving, President Obama signed off on another 10-year arms deal for Israel. Huge amount of support. In other words, Israel knows that the U.S. is firmly in its corner, and that's with Democrats, Republicans, and so on. But here you have Trump and Pence taking the next step. In other words, gratuitously announcing that the U.S. will recognize that Jerusalem, historic Jerusalem, will now be the capital, be recognized as the capital of Israel. Something that's not only untrue, but it's in defiance of all international laws, including the original partition agreement.
Indeed.
Way back when, in 47, 48. It's gratuitous. And what the world thinks about the leading superpower in the world, what it thinks about its leaders, actually has an impact. And I just wonder whether this is a case of going too far, the hubris, the arrogance, just too much, so that that down the road, maybe now, maybe in a few months, maybe in a few years, but there will be unintended consequences for the U.S. carrying out this gratuitous policy.
And I will add something to that, too. Whenever this administration is challenged on this gratuitous policy toward the Israelis, and that's exactly what it is, it's gratuitous, they double down. So the more Americans and others have complained about this decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem, the more the administration has pushed the idea forward to the point where the vice president just 2 days ago in Israel announced that we would move up the move. He's already identified the land and the building is going to start being constructed. And the physical move will now take place in 2019, only 1 year away.
Yeah. Ambassador, what's the mood right now amongst the Palestinians? Of course, there's the Palestinians in historic Palestine, that is the overseas Palestinians, the Palestinians in refugee camps, the diaspora. I mean, when this overwhelming sort of approach by the United States is also triggering a lot of sympathy and support in terms of public opinion for the Palestinian people. But what's the mood inside or among Palestinian people?
Well, actually, you know, thanks to Trump and for his announcement, that there is now a lot of cementing and bonding between the Palestinians in the occupied territories and that in the diaspora, let alone the 20% of Israeli population that are Palestinians, you know, have shown their solidarity with their brothers inside the occupied territories when they had, you know, showed the signs that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Palestine. If this shows something, it shows that this solidarity now among the Palestinians, which is creating a consensus among all the Palestinians, whether in the diaspora or under the occupation of Israel, gives us the momentum to work further in our diplomatic efforts to find alternatives to the United States brokership. And as you know, the speech that President Abbas gave in Brussels yesterday was received, I mean, by the European Union with great admiration. And the bilateral meetings that he has, had with the Belgium Prime Minister was also very fruitful. I think, you know, there should be a stand now by the European Union because we can see the alternative for brokership by the EU. Or, of course, you know, we have always the options of the United Nations because all the resolutions that were, you know, made concerning Jerusalem had a framework of international legality where we are pursuing, you know, all the legal aspects of how to settle, I mean, the question of Jerusalem. In general, is a time, I think, where we have to think clearly and loudly that the Americans have failed. 24 years of a stalemate in the peace process, nothing has moved except building more settlements, creating facts on the ground. And, you know, Francis Bridges just epitomizes the fictional reality that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Under what law, under which legality the United States makes such a move? I think, you know, they have preempted basically the entire peace process. They have preempted the final status talks. And such a decision is catastrophic, not only to the peace process, but to the American national interest, because even the European allies, and I tell you as an ambassador to the UK, there is a wide gap now in terms of perception, in terms of approach to the peace process, in terms of looking, you know, at the issue of moving the embassy. There has been clear stand by the British government that they're not going to move their embassy. They think East Jerusalem should be settled in the negotiations bilaterally, and that East Jerusalem is an occupied city. So we can see a wedge now in terms of positions by the Europeans and the Americans. And I don't think America is going to wield more power, I mean, diplomatically, to support the state of Israel. I think the United States made a grave mistake by being on the other side and mainly saying that, you know, we are totally supporting the state of Israel.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in the studio in Washington with Brian Becker. We're speaking from London with Ambassador Emmanuel Hassassian, the Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom, and from Amman, Jordan by Daoud Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Gentlemen, switching to something a little more historical, the New York Times Magazine published today an article which essentially says that the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, made a decision in 2004 to assassinate Yasser Arafat. 3 weeks after this decision was made, Arafat mysteriously became sick, soon after had a stroke, and died. Now, he has since been exhumed from his grave. His body has been tested, and the tests have been inconclusive. So we really don't know one way or the other how this played out. Daoud Kouteb, have you heard, well, of course you've heard allegations like this before. Can you tell us some of the background and what you know?
Daoud, if you would, I want you to also, if you don't mind, comment. I think it's unusual that this has appeared in such a major way.
In a major American publication.
In the New York Times, like whether this has any significance, the timing of this kind of story, even though the news isn't that new. But go ahead, start from the beginning.
Well, it is significant in the sense that it is a major U.S. publication. But I think, you know, if you would interview 95-98% of Palestinians today, they would tell you that Arafat was killed, that he didn't die in a normal, healthy situation. So the feeling, and, you know, he's called the Shaheed, he's called the martyr, and very few people have really questioned that he died from natural causes. There is a very strong feeling among Palestinians, and of course it's repeated in every occasion that Arafat was killed by the Israelis, and they have different, I mean, there's always the timeline that you kind of referred to is often reflected, and the Israelis have always been you know, accusing Arafat of they were inciting against him, and they were not happy with what was happening in the Mukata. So the fact that now a New York Times paper has said what people have already been talking about for years and years does not surprise me. You know, the Israelis have a habit of doing something we call in Arabic killing a person and walking in his funeral, you know? I mean, they pretend not to be involved in different acts that they've actually committed themselves. So it doesn't really surprise many people that this information comes out, but it is significant in that it came out in the New York Times in such a strong way. The point is now, you know, reflective of the brutality that the Israelis have. You don't agree with them, they will push you. They will. I mean, even today, Mahmoud Abbas is often worried about his own life, because every time you disagree with the Israelis, they can find different ways to make your life difficult and possibly even kill you and assassinate you. And that has happened to Palestinian leaders in Europe and Palestinian leaders in Palestine and in Gaza. So at times they take full credit for these assassinations, and at times they don't make any credit for it. But the fact is that people, the perception is, and actually the perception sometimes is much more important than the fact, the perception is very strong that Palestinians feel that Yasser Arafat was killed one way or another by the Israelis or any of their agents.
If the Palestinians were to engage in assassinations, they're labeled terrorists. If they even defend themselves, they're labeled as terrorists. I want to read from the article. Again, this is the New York Times Magazine. It'll take me 30 seconds to read through this. On March 22, 2004, an Israeli helicopter gunship struck down Sheikh Ahmed Yassin on the streets of Gaza City. Yassin was a founder of the Hamas movement and, like Arafat, a political leader of world renown. On April 23rd, Sharon told an Israeli reporter that he was no longer bound by his 2001 agreement with Bush, saying, quote, "This commitment of mine no longer exists," close quote. Asked to clarify if he meant harming Arafat, he answered, quote, "I do not think this matter can be made any clearer." That's Ariel Sharon, close quote. And then suddenly Arafat, the man who had managed to elude death so many times, succumbed to a mysterious infection that led to a stroke. He died on November 11, 2004 at 75. And again, the issue was whether a polonium, a radioactive material that had been used in assassinations, were or were not found on Arafat's clothes and remains. But Ambassador, as Daoud said, of course, within the Palestinian community and among Palestinians, this case is closed. This is not a big news flash. This is not. This would be like news flash. The sky is blue. But for the New York Times to publish it as it has, and while coinciding with Mike Pence's trip to the Knesset, where Mike Pence and Trump are taking such a hard line, such an aggressive line, and where I have to say, very frankly, I'm involved in organizing to help organize a protest at the upcoming APEC conference here in Washington, D.C., I would say there's been a sea change in public opinion in the United States regarding Israel. It used to have a rubber stamp, not just from the government, but from the people of America. That rubber stamp doesn't exist. And even among Jewish American people, I would say the majority of younger Jewish American people repudiate the Israeli government's policies. Ambassador, we have 1 minute left. Let me have you have the last word, if you would.
Yeah, well, actually, I totally agree with Dawood's, explanation about the public opinion in Palestine concerning the assassination of President Arafat. There is no doubt in our mind that, the Israelis were involved in this, in the killing of Arafat. And the 1,000-page report that came out from the French hospital has been hush-hushed. And definitely it has been hush-hushed by the United States of America not to stir any more combustive violence in reaction to the autopsy and to in reaction, to the causes of death. But however, I think Pence's visit to the occupied territories, and I call it occupied, and not Israel, is the fact that, this is a sign that, we Americans have made our decision to be on the side of Israel. And if you, Abbas and others, don't like it, to hell with you. And we have our own way of getting rid of you and creating alternatives. And that's why, I'm confident that, President Abbas now is afraid about his life because he has been threatened many times by the Israelis. And this is not something new that we hear, about, the threatening attitude. But the thing is, in the final analysis, if President Abbas, who has been, portraying his pragmatism in dealing with the issues for the last 11 years or so since he became, the president of Palestine, who else can be more pragmatic than this president who chose between constraints and wanted to hang in there for an ultimate peace deal that would render the Palestinians their independence on the borders of 1967? I cannot see any other partner.
I'm sorry that we have to leave it there, Mr. Ambassador. We are completely out of time. We're joined from Amman, Jordan by Dawood Kutab, an award-winning Palestinian journalist, and from London by Ambassador Emmanuel Hassassian, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Did you know that Donald Trump's father started off building affordable housing? Did you know that Donald Trump may be descended from a serial killer? Did you know that Trump is the first president to have children by three different women, or that his children have never been permitted to have pets? Well, we're joined from Arizona by Ruth Ann Monty. She's the author of a terrifically entertaining new book called Donald Trump in 100 Facts. Ruth Ann, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Ruth Ann, the idea behind this book is so simple that I kick myself for not thinking of it before you did. It's just so entertaining, and you lay out these 100 facts and have the stories behind the 100 facts, and it makes for a book that I could not put down. How did you come by this idea? What made you want to put pen to paper?
Upon this idea is that I had heard of this series by Amberley Publishing called In 100 Facts. A friend of mine had published a book on the English Civil War in 100 Facts, sent me a copy, and I congratulated him and said we should do something like Donald Trump in 100 Facts. That didn't happen. He has a busy lecture schedule. So I contacted the publisher through him and made the pitch. And they were initially very reluctant. They didn't think that there would be 100 facts to write about, which I thought was pretty funny. But the day after Trump's speech at the United Nations, they contacted me and said, here's a contract. So that's how it all started.
You know, I want to give some examples to our listeners about what kind of facts we're talking about. There are so many here that are so interesting, but I think some are so important we ought to highlight them. So you talk in the beginning of the book a lot about Donald Trump's father, Frederick Trump. Frederick, is it Christ or Christ? I've never been clear on what exactly Fred Trump's middle name was.
No, that's a really good question. I was working during the inauguration, and I'm pretty sure I did watch it because I remember it was a very brief speech, but I don't remember. Oh, it's not Donald's middle name, so it wouldn't have. I remember he said Donald John Trump, but I don't know. I do know that Fred Jr., Donald's oldest brother, was a student at Lehigh University, and his fraternity brothers, he joined the Jewish fraternity, thought it was hilarious that his middle name looked like Christ.
Yeah, Christ. And they liked that at the Jewish fraternity. You say there here that that no one had more influence over Donald Trump than his father, Fred, whose drive and ambition he inherited. But unlike his son, Fred built houses and flats priced for middle income and working class families. And here's where it gets even more interesting. During the war, E. Trump and Son took advantage of U.S. government funds to build houses for returning soldiers and their families. In Meet the Trumps, journalists Wayne Barrett and Gwenda Blair noted the irony that a New Deal program was Fred's big break. He was first in line in the New York regional office to apply for funds, Blair remarked. So it was because of a government program that the Trump family got started in real estate, and they got started in affordable housing in Queens. That's not to say that Fred Trump wasn't a racist. He actually joined the Ku Klux Klan and was noted for his racism to the point where Woody Guthrie actually wrote a song about old Fred Trump.
That's correct. And I was very surprised to learn all of this. But the actual fact is that the E. Trump and Sons was a construction firm that was founded a couple of decades at least before the Second World War by Trump's father, Fred. He'd started it with his mother because he was too young at age 18 to open a bank account. So she opened one for him, and he started building houses. The Depression really brought him down, which happened to a lot of people in the Depression. And so when this program started to encourage people to build low-income housing for returning soldiers, he jumped on it. And it was a great move on his part.
We're talking with Ruth Ann Monty, who's the author of Donald Trump in 100 Facts. Ruth Ann, some of these chapters that you have are funny, but some are deadly serious. I want to talk for a minute about Roy Cohn. You say here that Fred Trump Sr. was Donald's primary mentor growing up and in his early days in business, but his other mentor was Roy Cohn, who's the notorious prosecutor of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in 1951. Cohn was the one who questioned Ethel Rosenberg's brother, who actually just died about 2 years ago in his 90s, living under an assumed name in Queens. It was Ethel's brother and his testimony that doomed his sister and brother-in-law to the death penalty. It was Cohn who sought that death penalty, and the Rosenbergs were executed in 1953. Well, Roy Cohn went on to become Donald Trump's personal attorney. That is until Roy Cohn came down with AIDS, in which case Donald Trump cut him off and never spoke to him again. Tell us about Roy Cohn and this relationship with Donald Trump.
Well, Roy Cohn was already, a very big attorney in New York at that point, after the Army hearings in the 1950s, in which he sought to show that there were communist infiltrators in the United States Army. And the famous line is, "Have you, sir, no shame." He left Washington and went back to New York and opened a private practice to make a lot of money. And he made a lot of money representing a lot of very rich clients. And Trump was attracted to that. So he introduced himself to Cohn at one of the private clubs that he belonged to. And the two of them became very good friends. For many years, they were very close friends. And somewhat inexplicably, Trump dropped him when Cohn had AIDS. He was already aware that Cohn was gay. And I've not really come across anything in which would suggest that Trump had any problem with gay people. I mean, if you are, then you're just not going to do quite all that well in New York. But for whatever reason, he just decided he wanted nothing more to do with him. And Cohn complained to someone that Donald kisses ice water, and he died a few weeks after he was finally disbarred by the New York Bar Association. Well, his big role was defending the Trump Organization, what was still called E. Trump and Sons, against a Justice Department lawsuit for discriminating against black applicants in violation of the Fair Housing Act. It was fairly well known that if you were black, you were just not going to be able to rent an apartment from the Trumps. And that was something that Woody Guthrie was so angry about, because he did rent an apartment as a returning war veteran from the Trump Organization. And he was shocked when he realized that blacks were not on the property. There were no black tenants, and that they were actively discriminated against. Now, this was before the Fair Housing Act, but Woody Guthrie was very active in, you know, the budding civil rights movement. And he did write a very angry song about old man Trump. Roy Kahn was the one who defended the Trumps against the Justice Department lawsuit. They settled it. And it looks on paper that the Justice Department really won, because the Trumps they were ordered by the judge to become personally familiar with the Fair Housing Act. And, they had to put out advertisements in the major newspapers saying, we are an equal housing opportunity or something to that effect, landlord, and basically eat their words. But because it was settled, Trump considered it to be a victory. That's how he thinks.
You speak at length about really lifelong accusations against Donald Trump that he was and is a racist.
Yes, and again, that's something that I don't recall from growing up. But when I did my research, I was quite shocked to learn about things like the Central Park Five.
So let's talk a little bit more about Donald Trump's apparent history of racism. There was a very famous case from 1989 called the Central Park Five. A woman was jogging in Central Park. She was accosted by a group of people. She was beaten and raped. And later, five African-American teenagers were arrested. They were charged. They were convicted of this crime. And it was only later that DNA evidence exonerated them and showed that they were completely innocent of the crime. 2 weeks after their initial arrest, Donald Trump took out full-page advertisements in all four New York City daily newspapers to demand that all five of these teenagers be given the death penalty. Now, the evidence wasn't in. They hadn't been convicted of a crime at that point, yet Donald Trump wanted death for all five of these teenagers. Can you talk about that?
Yes, and that was something that really shocked me. I personally did not remember what Trump was doing. I didn't live in New York at the time. I was certainly very aware of the attack. But Trump wasn't on my mind. I lived away from New York, so I was kind of spared that. But the defendants later said, once they were released and grown, that they think that was the nail in the coffin, that he had so prejudiced the population, the locals, that he wanted to have the death penalty reinstated just for them. And these, again, were all except I think two of them were minors. They were questions. The younger ones were questions without without their parents present. Only one of them, his mother arrived at the police station in time to halt any questioning until she could get an attorney. But they were tried together, or they were tried in two groups, and both groups were found guilty. And the evidence, the DNA evidence came forward later on. Another prisoner went and confessed that he had actually done this, and this was after they had already spent decades in prison. Once they were released, and again, the DNA showed that each and every one of them was clean. Trump's comment was, well, what were they doing in Central Park? They must have been doing something.
Unbelievable. Because they're black, they have no right to be in Central Park after sundown.
Right, right. Now, I mean, this was an era where there was an awful lot of crime in Central Park. But to just simply say, I was in Central Park, therefore I am a criminal, that's taking it beyond a stretch. That's just unconscionable. And he's never backed down from that. In fact, he was furious when New York State settled with the five defendants. They've settled with them to compensate them for all those lost years in prison, which is basically would have been their prime earning years.
Yeah.
And he was furious that there was a settlement for them because they must have been guilty of something.
I want to change tacks here. You tell a story that is really quite troubling. This is the 17th fact in the book. It says, a feud with Fred Trump III led Donald to cut off medical support for a sick great-nephew. This great-nephew had cerebral palsy, and and the whole family ended up in court suing each other. Tell us about that one.
Well, what happened is Fred Trump Sr. died from Alzheimer's disease, and apparently his last will and testament, which was done within the last year or so of his death, made a lot of changes that many people in the family were unaware of. The major changes were cutting out the children of his son, Fred Trump Jr., from his will. Now, Fred Trump III did work for the Trump Organization at the time. His grandfather died. He gave one of the eulogies at the funeral. And about, I think, 48 hours after the funeral, his wife gave birth to a severely disabled child who had infantile seizures, very, very serious, needed around-the-clock care. And initially, Trump's younger brother, Robert, called him and said, "Don't worry, we'll take care of everything." But when they read the will and he realized that he was cut out of the will, that he and his sister were cut out of the will, he realized that Uncle Donald probably had something to do with this. In fact, he was convinced that Donald influenced Fred Sr. to alter his will and cut out these children, these two children from the will and obviously their descendants. And they sued. Fred III and his sister sued. At that point, Trump cut off their medical care and fired him. The medical care and the working for the Trump Organization were not really connected. Fred Trump had always provided medical care for his children and his grandchildren. But once Donald was in control of the entire organization, when his father became incapacitated, he could really pick and choose who could get medical care regardless of where they worked. So while he fired his nephew probably thought, well, at least I still have medical care. And then that ended. While the child had already had several hospitalizations, really needed a lot of expensive care. Even back then, medical care was very expensive. And so Fred III went to court and sued to be reinstated in the will. And that way he could provide medical care for his child until he found other employment, which he did. And the boy is still alive, but he does have cerebral palsy.
And I take it that that Fred III and his uncle do not speak.
They claim that they're cordial with one another, but if I were Fred, I would say the same thing, regardless of how I felt. And he did win the suit. He did. I don't know what the settlement was, but he did receive, you know, it was found that something weird had happened. There was a settlement. Everything was always a settlement with the Trumps.
Always. Always a settlement with Donald Trump. Before we get to Donald Trump and his relationship with women, I have to ask you one question that's just, I've been thinking about it since I first read the book. Is Donald Trump descended from a werewolf or a serial killer?
Well, in this case, the werewolf was a serial killer, wasn't he?
In all seriousness, though, explain what you mean by a werewolf.
Well, a researcher at one of the California universities, I don't have that on the top of my head at the moment, discovered and published a finding he had that Trump was descended from someone in Germany named Trump, and the family name was Drumpf or Trump. There's been a few different versions of it. And this one, Trump, was convicted of being a werewolf. He was clearly a psychotic. He murdered about 13 or 14 children and ate them.
Nice.
He murdered his own son and ate his son's brain, and he was obviously arrested, and the court decided that he was a werewolf, and he was executed as such, but they didn't do it right, because only a silver bullet can really kill a werewolf.
That's right, only a silver bullet can kill a werewolf. In fairness, we're talking about, what was it, the 1600s?
It was something like that. It was long ago when people still believed in werewolves and things like that. It kind of tied in neatly with the fact that his mother emigrated on a boat called Transylvania.
Nice. Very nice.
But this was a finding by a professor in California, and he published the story on Halloween 2017. And I just thought it was absolutely hilarious. This guy did have a lover who had a similar last name, which was actually Trump, T-R-U-M-P, and she was arrested alongside him as possibly a co-conspirator. But I don't believe she was killed. I haven't found any evidence that she was executed. Certainly, she was considered he was considered one bad hombre, and she was probably not much better.
Without a doubt. Let's talk about Donald Trump and his history with women. There, you have a whole bunch of different facts related to Trump and his treatment of women. You say he's been married more than any other president, but he started as a second husband. And his affair with
Marla. I haven't been aware of that.
No, I didn't know that until I read it in your book. And his affair with Marla Maples went on for several years in public before Ivana, his first wife, just couldn't take it anymore and issued him an ultimatum.
And that didn't really work out so well for her, did it?
No. And actually, her divorce settlement was just pennies on the dollar with what I would have expected.
It was. Both of his wives didn't do all that well on divorce settlements, although Ivana probably can't really complain too much. She still has, her Trump Avenue, her Trump Tower apartment.
Yeah, and the 30-room mansion in Greenwich, I think she got.
Yeah, she's getting by. It had been mentioned on Rupert Murdoch's newspaper. It was on page 6 of the Daily News, which is a gossip sheet, basically. And, she'd been mentioned in it with Trump before. And he made the grand gesture of taking both his wife, family, and mistress on the same ski vacation one year where there was an encounter in a restaurant. And, I wouldn't say that fists were flying, but certainly words were flying. And Ivana finally just gave up. There was just too much Marla going on in the background.
And then he got tired of Marla after a while.
Yeah, he got tired of Marla. In fact, he didn't even marry her until after their daughter was born.
Right.
And when he divorced Marla, they had actually been separated for some time. He kind of rushed it so that she would not make it to a clause in the prenup that would say, if there's a divorce, you get more money. I guess it was sort of like for every 5 years you're married, you get more money out of a divorce settlement. And he kind of rushed it along so that she wouldn't reach that threshold.
Very calculating.
Extremely calculating. That was one of Roy Kahn's, Roy Kahn's fingerprints on that as well. He negotiated all of his prenups.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, the first two at least.
You also say that there are dozens of women, not just the ones that came out during the campaign, but many dozens of women who say that they've been harassed or abused by Donald Trump over the years. This isn't some new phenomenon. It didn't just start happening during the campaign or immediately preceding the campaign. This goes back decades, does it?
It seems to be going back decades. I think the most disturbing element of it is his just brazenly walking through the dressing room for Miss Teenage America, where, you are dealing with minor people, minor children, really. I think they're like age 14 to 18. And he would just breeze through the dressing room while they're in various states of undress. And he co-anchored it, one year with Ivanka, his daughter, who was about the same age as the contestants. And a few of them complained to her. And she said, yeah, he does that. He didn't touch any of them. But he seemed to think, I own the dressing room so I can walk through it whenever I want. And that is one of the things that he later bragged to Billy Bush in that, infamous
That's right.
taping of Access Hollywood.
That's right.
That he could just simply walk through the dressing rooms of beauty contestants, including those who are still underage.
We're speaking with Ruth Ann Monty. She's the author of a newly released book called Donald Trump in 100 Facts. And Ruth Ann, it's my understanding also that that the book has been doing so well, you're already going into a second printing. Is that correct?
It looks like it will have a second printing. I've been asked to go through the first edition and update some of the facts that have changed. I finished my draft in November, and within 2 weeks, things had already changed. So they've asked me to go ahead and prepare it for an eventual second printing. It did sell about 25% of the printing within 2 days.
Which is phenomenal. I can tell you, I've written 3 books myself, and if you can sell that many copies in the first couple of days without major national media coverage, then the thing is going to take on a life of its own. Hey, I want to switch over to kind of a funny story. It seems to me to be very Trump, this story. So Donald Trump insists that he owns an original Renoir painting. It's clearly a forgery. It sits in a museum. The original sits in a museum. It does not belong to Donald Trump, but he insists that this painting is real. And I want to give a little bit of background to our listeners. Tim O'Brien is a journalist who has written extensively on Trump. In 2005, he published a biography called Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald. And he tells a story in this book that Trump believes he owns a painting by French Impressionist Pierre-Auguste Renoir. O'Brien remembered enough of the conversation to relay it to Vanity Fair, you say, in 2016. He says he asked Trump, who had it hanging in his private plane at the time, if it was the original. Yes, Trump answered. Donald, it's not, O'Brien says, he told him. I grew up in Chicago. That Renoir is called Two Sisters on the Terrace, and it's hanging on a wall at the Art Institute of Chicago. That's not an original. The Vanity Fair interview caught the attention of the Art Institute, which told the Chicago Tribune that they are certain that theirs is the real thing, and then they go through the provenance, which means that Donald bought a fake Renoir, probably at great expense, and he has bragged to people that it's worth $10 million. It's actually not worth $10 million. Two art historians were willing to go on the record about Trump's painting for ArtNet News. They separately studied a photo of Melania Trump posing in front of the painting, and they both say it's a fake. But he says it's the real thing. And I have to tell you, this story doesn't surprise me one iota.
I was in stitches when I read this one. This was one of the few facts that really had me rolling on the floor, quite literally, in a couple of instances. He also bragged that he owns another Renoir that actually hangs in one of the smaller galleries in London. You know, there's just no end to his reality, is all I could say. He just, you know, alternate facts, that's something he's been living for decades, it seems.
Right.
And I really was not aware of this when I started researching this book. I started this book because I really did want to separate facts from fiction. I was very concerned about all the things that, you know, were being said after the election and during the campaign. And I wanted to find out, you know, is my president, you know, is he living in the same reality as the rest of us? And my conclusion is that he is not. He cannot admit when he's wrong.
Yeah, he cannot admit when he's wrong, even when the evidence is as clear as day.
Yeah, and to me, that's very, very troubling. I mean, nobody likes to be told they're wrong. But when you're wrong and you're a grown-up, you say, I was wrong. Now, the painting itself, I mean, Renoir did not make copies of his paintings. It's possible that one of his students made the copy.
Which happens all the time.
He probably did pay a lot of money for it.
He probably did. And then it should be attributed to the Circle of Renoir.
But, you know, it's just not the real thing. And if he wants to believe it's real, well, I guess he's really not hurting anybody. But I would be curious to see how it insures.
Ruth Ann, we've got about 2 minutes left. I want to talk finally here about your 95th fact, and that is that therapists have devised coping mechanisms for what they're calling Trump stress syndrome. Can you talk about that?
Well, I felt it myself after a while. It's basically that, you know, you follow the president, and this one's been followed like none other. You know, he's already had a very active Twitter feed. He made outrageous statements. He was always on the news. He was always there. And people were starting to get really stressed out by it. And, you know, the advice has been, don't watch the news, limit your social media. And if you really are disturbed by Trump, then do something active to change things. And, you know, you don't have to do anything crazy, but you can register to vote, for starters. You can, you know, help other people register to vote. You can join in a march like the women's marches that went on this weekend and last year at the same time. You can become a sort of activist, you know, write to your senators and congressmen when there's legislation that Trump says he supports that you don't support. In other words, do something for yourself and try not to make him the focus. In the end, national legislation does affect us all, but really what goes on in our states and our communities affects us much more closely. Trump can't, you know, do something about, he can't close my park, or my library is not going to close an hour earlier because of Trump. It's closing an hour earlier because, you know, the state and the city decided not to allocate enough funds for public libraries.
Right.
So if that bothers me a lot, then I write to my state congressperson, my state representative, my state senator. You know, it all does trickle down. It's just that the people with the most publicity, I think it's kind of safe to say that it's outsized for them.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we were joined from Arizona by Ruth Ann Monty. Ruth Ann is the author of a great new book called Donald Trump in 100 Facts. Go out and buy it. It's on Amazon.com. It's at BarnesandNoble.com, and you can order it through your local bookseller. Thanks so much for joining us, and very best of luck with this book.
Thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
All right. You too, then. Bye now.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, joined in studio by my co-host Brian Becker. The Attorney General today announced that the Department of Justice will be opening an investigation into the deletion of text messages between two former members of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russiagate team who are suspected of demonstrating a political bias. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor attorney who is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, and we're joined in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Gentlemen, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So, Dan, walk us through this. Yesterday, we heard complaints. Actually, we complained here on this show that the FBI apparently has deleted 5 months worth of text messages and claims to not have a backup system where these text messages might be retrieved. And these are messages exchanged between an FBI agent and his girlfriend, an attorney at the FBI, who were both involved in the Hillary Clinton email investigation. Republicans on Capitol Hill have been complaining that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has not been tough enough or proactive enough in this investigation. And then today, Sessions announced that the Department of Justice would begin an investigation into the deletion of these text messages. Is this a tempest in a teapot, or is this a serious issue that could actually develop into something?
Well, I mean, I think it may not be serious, except for the fact that, as you say, you have 5 months of deleted texts, especially when you're talking about an intelligence agency losing 5 months of texts. Certainly, it has to make one wonder what was in there. You know, it seems like it had to be more than an accident that those were lost. My understanding is that, you know, any text in general can be retrieved, even if you've deleted it through the cell phone provider. So I, you know, I'm very dubious about the claim that somehow this was an accident. And I think that therefore the FBI's kind of opened itself up to this. I mean, I certainly think the Justice Department has every right to try to find those 5 months of text and see if they have any value in shedding light on what the FBI is doing.
You know, I have to tell you on a personal level, I actually have some firsthand experience with the FBI and electronics. And there's no such thing as a deleted text message. Nothing is ever actually deleted. They've got these forensic teams at the FBI, and if they can't figure out what is what, they send it over to NSA. And believe me, they have forensic teams at NSA. So if something's been deleted, it actually has not really been deleted. And it's in there somewhere, and certainly it's retrievable. So I wonder if this is all a show on the one hand, or on the other hand, Dan, as you point out, I wonder if there's some obstruction of justice going on here.
Yeah, again, I think one has to worry about that. You know, in general, as we've known throughout history in this country, it's always the cover-up that tends to get people into trouble. And this has the smell of some sort of cover-up, as you say, when an intelligence agency whose expertise is to find things like deleted text and they can't find 5 months of them, one has to just wonder what's going on here.
Walter Smolarek, help us put this into a political context. Is this the politicization of the Russiagate investigation, or is there something more to this? Have crimes been committed, or may crimes have been committed here?
It's certainly a possibility. I mean, we can't say anything decisively, but I think that any fair observer would think that, you know, obstruction of justice or something like that might be a possibility here, you know, at least something to think about. You know, of course, the Mueller investigation, it was always political. It was always about a number of things, you know, about domestic politics, like why was this person who was, you know, not really trusted by the elite, even though he himself is a member of the elite, he's clearly not somebody who's, you know, representing the general interests of the people who really call the shots in the United States, Donald Trump. You know, how did all their electoral fail-safe mechanisms, you know, fail, right? The two-party system, the corporate media, blah, blah, blah. All the ways that they keep, you know, accepted political, you know, the political choices in the elections acceptable. The Mueller investigation, I think, is a way to you know, sort of trap the Trump administration in a certain geopolitical orientation. I mean, it has to do with U.S. domestic politics, of course, with supporters of Hillary Clinton or just people who are opponents of Donald Trump and would support anybody running against them. But, you know, if Trump has this sword hanging over his head of the Mueller investigation, the storyline in the mainstream media that he's, you know, some secret agent controlled by Vladimir Putin, then the foreign policy options that he can realistically pursue are pretty limited. So I think that the text messages that we do know about that these two FBI, you know, or former FBI related government employees exchanged is an indication of that. You know, they were talking about how, you know, this investigation would be like their fail safe or their backup plan or plan B. I forget the exact wording, but, you know, it kind of goes to show that this is all has a political motivation from the very beginning. And what the FBI could be doing here, it's possible that they're hiding, you know, even further, even more damning evidence of it.
And didn't Ed Snowden tell us in 2013 that the FBI, the CIA, and NSA were all working with the telecommunications providers to collect all this data? So even if the FBI has deleted these emails, wouldn't the telecom companies, or not emails, but text messages, wouldn't the telecom companies still have them?
And I think that's something that Jeff Sessions may pursue, you know, with this investigation. You know, we can never be sure when these announcements are really about like the internal White House fractiousness and, you know, somebody trying to ingratiate themselves with Donald Trump. You know, I think Jeff Sessions pulled a similar maneuver when several months ago, when it looked like his job was really on the line. He said, we're going to go, you know, have this big campaign against leakers and we're going to find the leakers. So I don't know if this is sort of a similar thing to try to ingratiate himself with Trump with some big announcement that Trump might like. But if it is a serious investigation, and very well it might be, I think it would be warranted. You know, not that, of course, the caveat here is that we all are political opponents of Jeff Sessions. I mean,
right.
But, you know, it would, I think, be warranted in this situation. And they could subpoena the cell phone carriers. And I think that might be their first order of business, actually.
Dan Kovalik, we have about a minute and a half left. I want to give you the last word on this. Should we be taking this thing seriously? Do you believe this investigation could actually lead somewhere? And if so, where would that be?
I mean, in general, on all this Russiagate stuff, my feeling is that there is no there, that, you know, as this shows, this particular example, everything is in this investigation. It has to do with everything but the merits of whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia in the 2016 election, right? It's about, you know, if you look at Paul Manafort, it's about his financial dealings mostly with Ukraine, for example. With Mike Flynn, it's not about the fact that he met with a Russian ambassador during the transition period. It's about the fact that he lied about the meeting. Here, it's about deleted emails. We never seem to actually get to what the substance of the claim here, and I believe we never will.
I have to agree. And this is something that you have said on this show repeatedly from the very beginning of this scandal. We've said the same thing, and I'm going to note again, you're the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. But you're right, there's no there.
Yes, and I think in the meantime, though, the relationship between the U.S. and Russia grows ever more tense and ever more, frankly, possibly on its way towards an armed conflict. And that is the scary thing about all of this.
Something we really have to worry about. That's all the time we have. We were joined from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And we were joined in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.